But for the set, who sees only cars, I wasn't present in the room until I spoke. Sorry to interrupt, Member Eureka, but you're being a little cruel. I hadn't intended the words to have a double meaning, but they did in some sense apply to how Eureka was treating Carlyle, as well as how they were taunting Cato. If my Sib's such a big baby, they can't cross a room to use the bathroom with a stranger in the house. They deserve some toughening up. Sib? Carlyle repeated, frowning his confusion. I smiled, apology. It is in no way your fault, Cousin Foster. Cato Weeksbooth is in that room, I pointed, and has been sending Eureka messages for several minutes. Cato desperately wants to cross through here to get to the bathroom, but they're phobically afraid of sensors. Carlyle followed my gesture, and may have been quick enough to glimpse a sliver of black hair and white cloth through the cracked door before it slammed. Sorry, Carlyle called. I had no idea. I shook my head. It's not your fault. There's no way you could have known. I moved close enough to Cato's door for my gentle voice to reach him. I'm taking the sensei downstairs now, Dr. Weeksbooth. No need to worry. I'll make sure they leave by downstairs, and I'll let you know when they're gone. I will not repeat the sob-strained mix of thanks and curses which Cato muttered back. No, they were not even curses. Just those words that sound like curses which children use who aren't quite brave enough to say a real forbidden word. Better not to meet him here, good reader. Cato Weeksbooth is a beautiful, if fragile, creature, and I will have you meet him when he is a little more himself. Today, you meet Eureka. I turned to Carlyle and gestured to the stairs. Shall we go down? Carlyle was frowning hard at Eureka, his pale forehead wrinkled by a consternated mix of guilt and blame. Why didn't you say something? I would have gotten out of the way. I don't help Cato be neurotic. It isn't good for them. Carlyle opened his mouth to object, but caught himself. He smiled. Not a forced smile, but the kind where we smile for ourselves, to force away a darker feeling. I'm the intruder here, so it's your business. I look forward to getting to know you all better with time, unless you still want to request a different non-cousin sensei. Eureka twitched. Is your opinion firmer now? My opinion about set-sets? I can't make up my mind from just talking to you for 2 minutes.
Most people make up their minds talking to me for no minutes. I guess you aren't horrible. If Occam approves it, you can stay.
High praise. Thank you. Carlyle waited, but a set-set does not smirk. Shall we? I invited, returning to the stairs. Yes, thank you. Carlyle turned toward Cato's door. I'm leaving now, Doctor. I'm sorry. The sensei made it almost to the stairwell before text froze him in place.
You never said why you really came back.
A third time, the same question. Bosch security may be Occam's domain, but Eureka is a watchdog, too. The keener, because they know how to make interrogation feel like playful nosiness. My breath caught. It wasn't just the danger in the question. It was the sight of Carlyle's face, which relaxed into a smooth, angelic tranquility. Beautiful and captivating like a piece of art, the statue smoothness of his cheeks, the childlike delicacy of his brows, the golden glimmer at the edges of his hanging hair. In that moment, he might have been his mother.
Sensei business, he answered in a light, sweet voice. I don't think I could describe it if I tried. You don't have the right background or terminology. After all, I've cultivated my mind for something too.
It is hard for me to express what extraordinary praise Eureka's reply carried.
Volker.
Why do we shorten the words most precious to us? Bapa from Bosch parent, Ba-sib from Bosch sibling. In old days, mom from mother, prince from princeps, pope from papa, and here the hasty Volker.
never the archaic vocateur. In 2266, when the work week finally shortened to 20 hours and crowds deserted those few professions which required more, the first anonymous, Aurel Gallet, rushed to defend vocation with a tract which is still mandatory reading for 3 hive entry programs. "Why is a calling passive?" he asked. "Why is one called helplessly to one's vocation, when surely it is an active thing? I find my calling, take it, seize that delight, that path before me, make it mine. I call it like a summoned magic. It does not call me." His new word, vocateur, one who calls, was born to remind us that a person with a strong vocation is not a victim driven helplessly to toil, but a lucky soul whose work is also pleasure, and to whom 30, 40, 50 hours are welcome ones. Surely the inconvenience of pronouncing one more syllable is a small price to commemorate a term so powerful that here it cuts across the barrier to thrill the hearts of both cousin and Setset. Carlyle smiled a true, warm smile at the compliment. "You too." I led him down to Thisbe's empty room. There was a special feeling of release as I closed the door behind us, like shutting out the swelter of a fearsome August. I could see from Carlyle's easing shoulders that he felt it too. "How did you know I'd come back?" he asked. "You're a sane person, Member Foster. After what you saw, how could you not come back?" He laughed, but only for a moment. "It was real, right? I didn't imagine it." "It was real," I confirmed, and I watched his face relax as at the touch of dew. "I've been telling myself it was real, thinking about nothing else. I mean, I didn't doubt my memory. I remember clearly, but the more I thought about it, the more it felt like it couldn't be real." It took me months to stop needing to be reassured. "Sit, please, Member Foster." My gesture had offered Thisbe's velvet-covered water couch, which took up half of one wall, but Carlyle chose instead my little folding stool, on which one could perch with energy, ready to spring. "No need to be so formal," he answered. "Just Carlyle is fine." "Carlyle," I repeated. "I will apologize in advance for slipping. Formality is rather a habit for me." "No problem," he smiled. "And you prefer Mycroft?" "Yes, if you please." I knelt and took up my scrub and vacuum. "It was real. You'll probably need reassurance often. You shouldn't call me, my tracker's monitored, but I assume you have Thisbe's tracker number already. Thisbe should be willing to answer if you need to hear somebody say it's real." He nodded. "Do you have... I was hoping to see proof again. The little soldiers or something." "Of course. I brought this for you." I rose and offered him a tiny paper book, too small to cover the surface of his pinky nail, even when opened. No matter how keenly our lenses zoom in on that book, they only show more detail. The letters finer than pinpricks. The surface of the paper, thumb-smeared corners and food-stained favorite parts. It is not beyond science to make such an object, but it is beyond technology Thisbe and I might plausibly access. Carlyle took some moments to explore the tiny proof. "May I? Is it too much to ask to keep this? To remind myself?" "Nothing leaves here. No physical evidence. Not yet. Not until Bridger decides they're ready." "I understand." He stroked the tiny spine. "It's a big thing." "Yes." He paused. "It's the biggest thing, really. The biggest thing." I did not have an answer which would not have strained his vows. "Give yourself a scratch with the pages," I suggested. "On your thumbnail. They're so thin that static cling sticks them together into clumps. But if you can separate a good clump, you can give yourself a very visible scratch that'll last a long time as the nail grows out. It's not proof, but it's how I used to leave myself a reminder that it was real. It'll help. He looked from me to the tiny relic on his palm.
Yes. Yes, good idea, thank you. That's just the thing.
I smiled as I watched him struggle to get just the right sized clump, laughing a little inside. This was all so easy for Carlyle, with my 10 years' experience at his service. I was glad I could make it gentler for someone. When my world had been force rewritten in an instant, I had faced only tiny, hostile bayonets and toddler babble. Carlyle finished and sat back, smiling at his precious proof.
"What are you doing?"
he asked, nodding at my chemical scrub. "Destroying evidence. There was a break-in upstairs. The police must not find signs of Bridger." I smiled to make it feel less criminal. "Thisby's out on a date and Bridger's gone to bed, but I will answer whatever questions I can for you. If you're like me, you'll have 100 new questions a day for the next month." His smile grew sheepish.
"I do have a lot of questions. What are the limits of this power? What exactly can Bridger do?"
"The big one first. I have no idea what limits, if any, Bridger's power has. I can only describe what I've seen them do. They can animate representations. Any representation real enough to feel real to them. A mud pie, a doll, a drawing. That may be all they can do. Or there may be 1,000 other things, but Bridger is a timid kid and understands play and feels comfortable with toys, so that's the only sort of thing they've done so far." He nodded.
"When they make things real, do they become what Bridger imagines or what the maker of the thing imagines? You know how sometimes a kid might play with a doll that's supposed to be some movie character, but the kid doesn't know the character and invents a different one."
I nodded. "It seems to become something of a mixture. Bridger found a toy hot air balloon once and burned themselves on the fire inside. They knew what the balloon was, but not how it worked. But when they miracled it, it had fire anyway. And the soldiers' guns and things have working, moving parts which Bridger couldn't name or recognize. The soldiers speak modern English like a child would expect, but they don't have modern attitudes. They have attitudes of hundreds of years ago when those ancient soldier toys were made. They use he and she and swear by religious things in public and remember a darker age."
"Do they?" Carlyle frowned. "This is a hard question to phrase, but do they remember real things, real lives?
A toy doll of a fairy tale prince is pretend, but toy soldiers are representations of real soldiers who really lived. Has Bridger created pretend soldiers or recreated real people who really lived and died?"
"If they were real, there's no way to look them up. They don't have real historical people's names. They have the childish names Bridger gave them, Pointer, Croucher, Looker. But Bridger did miracle a real person once."
Wide eyes.
"They did?"
"A photograph from an old book. A friendly-looking person they wanted to play with. Emma Platz was their name. Bridger didn't make that one up."
"With flat pictures, it works as if you were talking to each other through a screen. The person on the other side can see and hear you, but you can't reach them."
Carlyle leaned toward me with such energy he almost toppled the little stool.
"Is there a whole world in the image? Can other people show up? Does time pass?"
I frowned. "We've only tried it the once. There's a limit to how much you can experiment with creating life before it becomes too cruel, for Bridger as well as for the subject. You know how kids fall apart when a pet dies and it was their fault. It was much worse with Emma."
"What went wrong?"
I felt myself wince at the memory.
"Emma couldn't stay in the portrait chair forever. Not without food and drink and having to go to the bathroom. They went out to the edge of the photo and never came back. We don't know why.
Possibly they ceased to exist when they left the frame, but from their end they said they could see all the other rooms and places in the house just fine.